Hi, I'm Ron Coleman, a partner in the Dillon Law Group, social media legend and free speech enthusiast. When I started the Coleman Nation podcast in the spring of 2021, its focus was on free expression and censorship on the internet. But as important as that subject is to me, which is very important, I felt hemmed in the podcast. I wanted to spend more time talking to the interesting people I've met in my legal and free speech work without feeling a need to have them all make the same point. So I culminated the first series of the podcast and have started the second series. I hope you'll enjoy these conversations as much as I have recording them. Hey, culminators. Today, we've got a very special culmination. Not only are we interviewing one of our best friends and a person who is wanted in several states, the renowned, pardon me, I'm nervous because he is a big shot, the renowned mafioso from New England, Mark Rondanza is joining us today. And we're doing this studio style here in the Dillon Law Group New York office in Newark, New Jersey. Mark, great to see you again.
Great to see you, my friend.
Mark came in and I gave you a nice big hug, and then he maybe give you a real substantial hug, which was Mark's way of saying, I'm not sick anymore. You don't have to treat me like a little frail.
Also my way of saying I miss you, and I'm grateful that I got to see you again, because that was not a certainty.
Mark, you were, but I guess it was by phone that you first told me that you were sick.
Yes.
A couple of years ago.
Probably just about a year ago.
And the thing about Mark is that he's always really been kind of this robust person that you could legitimately be afraid of, especially if you look at his girl funny or try to take a backhanded picture on the beach. Mrs. Coleman was very impressed with that story.
Was she?
And then I had noticed that you'd gotten quiet.
Yeah.
So Mark and I have been blogging and practicing law together, often on the same cases, for many years now.
Yeah.
And we've become very friendly. And whereas I haven't grown at all, I haven't changed. I'm a static character in pretty much every respect. That's really not true. I used to be one of those IP enforcement weenies.
Yeah.
When I was at Guest Fitzpatrick, not Guest Fitzpatrick, when I was at Gibney, Anthony, and Flaherty, which is basically the in-house law firm for Rolex. Mm-hmm. And I grew. I did grow. I moved a little bit more toward your side of the street, but you have moved considerably in many ways.
Yeah, I have.
You were recently telling me about a friend that you have and that you've known for many years, who is a stridently left-wing lawyer with very left-wing views, which would have made perfect sense to hang out with the Mark Rondanza that I knew 20 some odd years ago. The fact that this person fits that description and hangs out with you now is a tremendous testament to her uniqueness, it would seem.
Well, I mean, I've never chosen my friends with how much they agree with me.
I'm not talking about you, but it's the people from the other side that do seem to, as often as not, make their social decisions. There is hope.
There is hope.
What's going on? What is it that has, I mean, when I look at your Twitter feed now, you've got some really based views on some things. What changed? Raising kids, looking what the world has become of the world?
I don't really feel like I've changed. I feel like the world moved. I mean, I feel like I'm sitting pretty much in the same spot I've always been in. And yeah, some of my views have always been what the kids these days call based.
What would be an example of something with the year 2000 Mark Rondanza would say today as he would have said then, and that we would call based?
I have always been against institutional racism, which we now call affirmative action.
Okay, so that's a ballsy position to take now. Although, I mean, the world's been divided now into people who either are going along with that or who aren't admitting that they're not going along with that. I guess then there's the vast majority of people who won't admit that they're not going along with it.
But we don't need to do that. You know, I mean, look, if we didn't hang out with and tolerate and talk to people that we didn't really agree with, you and I wouldn't be friends.
That's true, because here's the thing. We always enjoyed each other's, you know, banter and company.
Yeah.
And I could tell that even though you were is there one thing that hasn't changed is you're a free speech absolutist. You were then.
Absolutist is like for Siths. You know, I'm more, you know, I.
Tell me, so where do we draw the line?
Yeah, I don't know. I just know that I shouldn't be drawing it because I lack that intelligence and that wisdom. You know, people say to me sometimes, like, you ever think of running for office? I'm like, God forbid. If I ever do, vote against me. And if I win, have an insurrection to keep me from taking power. It'll be terrible. Like I lack the maturity and the grace.
Well, you lack the politesse.
That's yes.
I mean, you have to. You really see it even among people that you know who are cool people, and then they get into office, and all of a sudden they have to start triangulating.
Yeah, but you know, when it comes to free speech, though, I. It's not unfair to call me an absolutist because I will tolerate a lot more than I think most people would. You know, I spend a lot of my day trying to talk friends of mine off the ledge about what should be prohibited and what shouldn't. But at the end of the day, I think it's still more speech is always the way to fix something.
So give me an example of one of those conversations.
You know, I have a really good friend. I'm proud to call him my friend, Ken Turkell. He handled the Hulk Hogan case in Florida, and he sent me a picture of a poster that
he represented
Hogan.
So he's the plaintiff's lawyer. He won that one. It was a defamation. It was an invasion of privacy claim.
It was, yes.
Okay.
So, you know, we had a mutual friend who introduced us. We hit it off great. But he sends me a poster of essentially encouraging Intifada-like actions. And he said, isn't this incitement? I said, well, you know, it's not. It doesn't have the immediacy.
Why do so many lawyers not understand just how virtually, how the incitement exception mm-hmm. to the First Amendment is so narrow as to be essentially useless for analytical purposes?
You know, probably just they don't do this, Ron. You know, it's like if somebody asked me, why don't you get these ERISA regulations? It's like, because I barely understand it.
But you're talking to a guy who has been in that space. He did the privacy, you know, stuff. So he had to, you know, he was hit with First Amendment defenses.
But think of also the kind of, I mean, well, I'm sure it's very easy for you to think of the emotional response to something when 500 million people are calling for your extermination. It's pretty difficult to say that's okay. It takes a special kind of guy to say that's all right.
So, right. I suppose it does. I mean, it is true that I have had to answer many Jewish people who have asked me that very question. Isn't this incitement?
Yeah.
So now, on the other hand, it literally is incitement. And people are getting beat up and people are being physically harassed. And yet all of a sudden, the environments where this is taking place, mostly higher education, they're super interested in free speech.
It is, you know, it's nice when somebody shows up to the party, but it's disappointing when they showed up just for the free food, you know? I don't see everything I hear coming out of higher education saying we've got to tolerate these awful, you know, this awful Palestinian pro-Intifada speech. We've got to tolerate this anti-Semitic speech because that's what the marketplace of ideas. I mean, it's like they stole my playbook. You know, they stole all my lines. But it is disappointing to think that it only came out now. And I can almost guarantee you that when it's no longer about Israel and the Palestinians, they'll return back to base.
So here's a question. This is like a pure freshman dormitory bull session question, because we'll never know the answer. I'm a little older than you, but not old enough to know the answer to this question. And on the other hand, you know more counterculture type people. Maybe you have some insight into it. Berkeley free speech movement. The whole thrust on the left toward free speech that occurred in the 60s.
Which is what attracted me to leftism.
So was that transactional, or was it just that they don't like how it turned out? What do you think?
I don't know. I've thought about this, you know, because when you think about all the great free speech movement cases and actions that took place in the 60s, the anti-war movement, and you look at all these old foundational cases, right? The NAACP cases and all that. And you think, yeah, these guys had the right principles. And then you look around today at I guess the people who've inherited their mantle, and you see that for them, it no longer washes. It no longer holds any weight. Yeah, it really makes you wonder. And it makes it so important for those of us who believe in that this is a neutral principle that we hold firm. You know, and I'm taking on people that agree with me also, because anybody who gets into power hates free speech all of a sudden. And when you're not in power, you don't like free speech. Maybe that's part of why I don't want to get elected to anything. I never want to leave. Like, I like where I am. You know, I really like who I am.
And I like who you are.
Thank you. Well, that's very meaningful to me. I mean, not just blowing smoke, you know, at you. I mean, it matters because it.
But you've actually, whether you meant to do it or not, you know, maybe stumbled on, or maybe you intended to dangle it in front of me. You've made a point, which is that free speech is at best neutral. Mm-hmm. It can't, but it's by being free speech.
Yeah.
It is inherently subversive.
Yeah.
It can be. So that inherent subversiveness can be neutered by your saying, listen, I've got complete freedom. And I think Hubert Humphrey is absolutely the man. What's astonishing is, you know, that you'll see people purporting to say, I mean, we just saw this yesterday, yesterday the video was circulating. Who's the guy, Joe, on MSNBC?
Scarborough.
Joe Scarborough. Joe Biden's never been sharper. I mean, he certainly hasn't been threatened with dismissal if he doesn't say something that stupid.
No, but did they threaten the editors at Pravda or in the Soviet Union? Did they threaten the editors at Granma? Or did they just know what
they know?
They know what the right thing to say is.
So that's if people take free speech and, you know, going back to the sort of this paradigm that I set up, the free speech is either going to be neutral. I'll have two Cokes, please.
Right.
Or I don't like the service around here. Now you're saying something.
Yeah.
When I use my free speech to say, this is the best restaurant I've ever been in, you're going to assume, why is it that we assume that I'm doing it to get, that there's, I must have some kind of agenda? Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's not like that.
Well, I mean, but it is. And look, it always has been. I mean, even back, you know, when I first became a lawyer, there were media entities that had, we saw like ownership changes. And then you see GE was controlling NBC and then all of a sudden writing great things about maybe we should go to war. I mean, there's always been some element of corporatism in our media.
Well, and not only that, I mean, just that reminds me of something else I thought of last night, which is that there's there are a lot of people on YouTube who like to make videos demonstrating how this product or this service or this innovation in modern life was really motivated by such and such mercenary objective. That's not particularly shocking.
Yeah.
people get out of bed in order to accomplish things. And that doesn't mean that every moment you're awake, that it's a good way to go through life, in my opinion, to be selling or to seeing what you can get out of life. But we operate, one of the fallacies of collectivism is that we take incentive out of the equation.
We do. But, you know, one of the consequences of too much individuality is that we don't feel responsible for each other as much. And I think we should. Now, I'm not about to go marching through the streets with a Che Guevara shirt on, but
The libertarian, the Ayn Rand crowd.
Yeah, they, everybody yells at me, Ron. Everybody.
About her?
No, about everything.
About everything.
I always get a kick out of it when I guess if I had to throw in with a camp, it would be with the libertarians. I'd be immediately thrown out.
Yeah, you'd be thrown. You also, I mean, you couldn't spend
not
a day.
Orthodox enough. When I get yelled at for not being an orthodox enough libertarian, I mean, I get yelled at for not being a good Catholic. I get yelled at for.
Well, you're not a good Catholic.
Best I can do.
No, it's not. I'm not letting him get away with that. That's just kind of the thing you can say that with lots of people, but not with Rabbi Rook. That's okay, though.
I try.
Well, all right. Trying versus I'm not even going to try is definitely a level.
It's a big change for me. Remember when I was an atheist?
Let's talk about that. What would make were you an atheist in the real sense as opposed to most people who I encounter say I'm an atheist.
Yeah.
And when I say I encounter, I mean in social media.
No, I was deep-seated.
In other words, you truly believe there was no God, not merely F you. You have religion. Yes. Well, I want to do what I want. You had it worked out.
I was jealous of people who believed. That's how much I knew there wasn't.
That there wasn't.
I said, if I could get hit in the side of the head with a brick and believe the next day, I was like, I would do it. I am jealous of them.
So you were jealous of people who had faith.
I was. And
why? Well, first of all, why? I think it's important for me to understand.
Well, I mean, just imagine there is something that has the power to create and perhaps control the universe that also loves you. You know, and you may see people you love after you die.
Okay, so that's life after death. It isn't the part about meaning that maybe there's meaning to all this that
I've hit now, but before it was just, it was sort of.
I'm saying the effect of that realization that what if there really were something bigger than all this, something creative and real, that would have made you feel better about life, but you couldn't find it.
Right.
And then what happened?
I was talking to a reporter.
How long ago?
About 2 years ago, three, maybe two and a half, 3 years ago. And they were doing another hit piece on me. You know, why do you represent all these awful people? And I told this story.
Brief point. My favorite awful people representation for Mark, and he has represented some real awful people. But when the Church of Satan fired him for being too right wing.
No, there was a schism.
Oh, there was a schism within the church. These are the people who say we represent all that is evil. We worship the dark prince. Oh man, your principles don't align with ours. And that's why I was asking about atheism, because a lot of people who claim to be Satanists or atheists, they just want to not be what you think is good in order to get under your skin. And I understand that wasn't you.
Yeah.
All right. So you were talking to a reporter 2 years ago.
Yeah. And she tried to, she was asking me, why do you represent these people and those people? And I told this story that I've often told about a Catholic priest I met back in the 90s. And I was trying to have small talk with him. And, what am I going to talk to a priest about? I got kicked out of Sunday school and, I was 10 years old. And that was the end of it. I said, so where's your congregation? And Father Licata says, I don't have a church. I minister at the prisons in maximum security prisons and death row. And I said, would you screw up to get stuck with that job? And he puts his hand on my shoulder. And immediately I was like, oh, I'm such a dick. Because he says, my son, I begged Rome for this job. And I thought, oh, I am such a dick. And I understood what he meant. You know, he was.
In other words, you realize as soon as you ask the question that you'd probably missed something.
Yes.
When you first.
Right. So Father Licata, you know, of course, obviously, I mean, was doing this because who better to minister to? And then people, he said, some of these people, they go off to death row, and I am the only person that ever cared for them. I'm the only person that ever loved them.
So, and
I'm no Father Licata, right? I'm not qualified to like carry his shoes, but that was very inspirational to me, even as an atheist, because I thought,
even as an atheist, my next question, which is that anyone can be impressed by the humanity of someone who wants to provide that balm that you in your own life acknowledged would have been helpful, all the more so someone who is about to end his life.
Yeah.
Or whose life is about to end. So that's step one. That right. just made you see things a little bit differently.
Right.
But that didn't make you believe in God.
No. So I was telling this, but I've told this story again and again to explain, like, I try to live up to Father Licata's ideals. Like, if somebody is the absolute worst of the worse the speech is, the more I want to defend it. Right. And it's because how better to show my principles than to defend speech for somebody I hate? You know, when we represented a Nazi, you know, Jay Woolman, my partner, you know, he's my goose to my maverick, man. That guy's awesome. But when I called him and I said,
I missed Jay.
Is it okay if I, you know, if we take on this Nazi client? He said, well, why are you asking me? I said, well, you know, I just feel like it's good manners to ask the Jewish guy if it's all right if we take in the Nazi. And he said, do you ever challenge my principles again? And I said, he's like, I want the case in. I want to work on it. I want my name on everything. And I thought, that's the Father Licata right there. You know, and I have an associate who on the day he was getting married to another guy, we worked on a case. You know, he insisted on billing for a client that wants to make gay marriage illegal. So that's that spirit. So I'm telling this story to this reporter. And, you know, the whole time I was an atheist, I would just say, look, just some stupid sign, for crying out loud. You know, how hard is it for you to give me a sign if you exist, you mook, right? And
God is a dancing monkey who should perform when you desire to be entertained.
Correct. Correct. This was my logic. And then as I was telling this reporter, the words came out of my mouth. Why do you think God put me there that day? In that parking lot with Father Licata. And I meant it. I got hit with the brick. I was like, oh my God. There's the sign. Right. And then I'm looking, and then all of a sudden,
this is your version of the guy on top of the roof during the flood.
I don't know what that
means. Well, this is good.
But
yeah. So the flood comes.
Yes. I sent the helicopter. I said,
right.
Yes.
God's I'm waiting for God to save me. I sent the helicopter and I sent the boat and
yes. And then a flood of images of every sign I had seen.
Yes, because the fact is, Mark, you've had a lot of meaningful things happen in your life. And one very well could say, here's where God elbowed you, and here's where God kicked you in the shins, and here's where God nudged you in the groin. You never felt that, because those are acts of love.
You've never been mad at me.
Really?
I think I amuse him.
Wow.
Look. Have I disappointed him? Sure. But, you know, when I got cancer, you know, it's ironic, right? You know, you come back from atheism and here you are. And now it's like, okay, well, surprise. And I remember saying to my mom, this is a reward.
This is advanced theology.
It was.
Because, I mean, we have a principle in Judaism that the righteous are tested, and that God does afflict people whose reward he's holding for them for later. And he, you know, But a lot of people had a have a lot of trouble with that.
It was the greatest gift I've ever had. I am so, like, I literally pray thanks for the cancer.
So that's incredible. That's amazing to me.
Well, look at all the trouble he went through.
That who went that God went through for you
to make that for me,
so to speak. It's not really trouble for him, but
right. But you know, it was. I mean, I had a lot of revelations in it. I mean, I'm not.
So then, did you return to the church?
Yeah. Yep. I'm...
So this is a gigantic point. I didn't ever really understand how to answer until I read. Actually, I didn't read the whole book. Jane read the whole book. I didn't read it. Yoram Hazony's book on nationalism.
Yeah.
And he explains how people have this problem. Well, why should I be more loyal to this culture, to this tradition,
mm-hmm.
which may or may not be embodied in a national group, just merely because I was born into it?
Why not?
Why not? And B, your very ability to answer that question is a product of who you are, and who you are is what your entire line of predecessors put into making you who you yep. are. So at least give the tradition you were born into the first shot.
That's how I looked at it. Yeah, I mean, I think you use the radio of Judaism to dial into the frequencies that God's pumping out. I use Catholicism. You know, we're both imperfect, and maybe the right answer is actually, you know, Zoroastrianism. I don't know, or maybe it's all right, but I don't know what Zoroastrianism yes. actually
well,
it's is.
Well, some people consider it to be the first form of monotheism.
Okay, well, you know, it could be anything.
But they certainly don't like it in Iran, which is where it was born.
But in any event,
yeah,
you know, yeah, connecting with, you know, it's my ancestors.
So,
so
now we have a problem. We like the First Amendment.
Yeah.
And we think that the idea of the freedom of conscience and freedom of speech make a great pair
yep.
for a pluralistic and flourishing society that could lead to great opportunity and abundance. I think, right? So far, so good. And now we take a couple million Northern Africans whose culture have imbued them with none of these values.
We can fix that.
Query number one, how much more were my Eastern European ancestors imbued with those values? And you're not Sicilian, are you?
Yeah.
You are Sicilian, the worst kind of Italian.
Right.
We're not imbued. I mean, you're
the lowest of the low.
Mafia values.
Right. No, my ancestors did not get off that boat.
So saying, what? You know. Yeah. So what?
Say my great. I hope my grandson's a First Amendment lawyer.
So we're talking about, you know, what's going on in these campuses and these people with their extremely violent inclinations, and they have been, I believe, accurately described as a pre-modern mentality. It's a very kind way of putting it, frankly. In a way that somehow our Eastern and Southern European forebears were not. I think that is there a difference, or am I wrong? Can these people be assimilated?
I think they can be. We can save them. Come on. If Father Licata could love somebody going to death row, and Jay Woolman can represent a Nazi, and I mean, we can save them. Now, I think I think one of the problems is a lack of oppression. Because that little bit of pressure on you makes you value that liberty so much that you want it for other people.
I know growing up. So which generation of immigrant are you? Your parents are American born.
Yeah, my grandparents were actually born in America too.
Well, so you're a real Yankee Doodle.
I mean, you know, I grew up in Gloucester, Mass, so that's pretty much a province of Sicily.
So, you know, yeah. You see in the picture? Yeah. So these are my grandparents. Oh, up here, right. My grandparents walking in the street in Warsaw, which, except for the fact that it was actually in the process of becoming a fascist state in an attempt to be with what was going on in, you know, the rest of Europe. It didn't help them in September 1939. It's a fairly, nonetheless, like, they looked like a couple of metropolitan Western people. It's just, you could, if you told me that they were walking in Milwaukee.
Now that's that was your grandparents.
My grandparents, yeah. My mother's parents, who subsequently moved to Cuba and thereby survived the war, unlike just about everyone they left behind. But when my grandfather, who's in that picture, his name, I've written about this before, his name was Yaakov, which the Yiddish, there's a Yiddish nickname of Yaakov, of Yankel. Why does the N sound get in there? Because it's an ah, ha, and the ah becomes a ya. And the Yiddish does funny things to sounds. So he used to say to me, I am Yankee Doodle. I am Yankee Doodle. He had this Cuban Yiddish accent that you had to hear. They were so proud to be Americans.
Yeah.
And he was a member of the Jewish Labor Bund. He was against capital. Not really. That was just what people who weren't religion did in the 20s in Poland. But in other words, religious life didn't work. What? Where are all the kids today? Oh, the Bund. Okay, I'm in the Bund. What we have seen so much in these demonstrations is this phenomenal contempt being directed toward the host country.
That makes me sad.
That's
Americanism is a thing. You know, it's a sub-religion. And I'm an adherent to
describe it.
I once
had to write an essay on this, and I don't think I did a very good job.
Look,
I was, of course, 14.
I believe in this the way I believe in God, the way I believe, you know, in being able to love a person. I look out at that. I mean, I told my girlfriend, I'm like, look, I'm never going to be completely monogamous to you. And she goes, what? Because Lady Liberty? And I'm like, you know how seen I felt at that moment? Do you know how deeply in love with her I felt at that moment? I was like, oh, boom, that just hit me. I was like, yes, right there, right? Because I do believe in it, you know? And
I need you to flesh that out. How, in other words, no, like, what's the relationship between this sort of philosophical freedom, this what we might call political freedom, yeah, and this idea that commitment in marriage, no, you were married once.
Yeah.
Now, you were married to a Judas, to a Jewess, weren't you?
No.
She was not Jewish.
No, she was not.
So why did your kids go to Jewish school? What was that about? Because it was a good school.
We were driving by it the day we were checking out schools, and it had a big sign, and I thought, this is going to be hilarious. Let's go check this out.
Hilarity ensued. Was she Catholic?
No.
Oh, so you were never married within the church?
No. So we went in, and I, you know, and they, he brought them in to see the classroom, and this little kid, Owen, comes up.
Oh, Owen, of course. Obviously one of the Hasidic boys.
Owen is my buddy. God, he's older now. He's actually an actor now, like a pretty famous actor. Owen comes up, tugs on my jacket, and says, Mister, can we hug your kids? And I was like, yeah, sure. And all the kids came up and hugged my kids. And I said, I don't care if this is a fascist, anarchist, Muslim academy. If that's what they're learning here, that's where I want my kids to go. And now, like,
the Randazes are not like the Colemans, folks. Just, you, I mean, we are great friends, but if the Colemans would have hightailed out of there.
I thought it was adorable. I said, this is what I want my kids to learn. So they went to the Temple Beth Shalom school, you know, and every Friday we would go to the Shabbat thing for the kids. And I had my custom made Italian flag kippah for me and my son.
Oh.
And my daughter one day, my daughter was a little more aware to hurt my son because they were fighting. I see her. She's got a stinger on her. She is a that kid. I am terrified of her, and I adore her at the same time.
How old is she now?
She is 15 now, and she is amazing. But I saw the vipers, like the stick. She pulled that stinger back, and she goes to my son. She says, "You know we're not Jewish." And he says, "Well, yes, we are." No, he says, "Daddy, we're Jewish, right?" And I was like, "No, well, why do we go to that school? I'm like, because it's a nice school. You know, and this is all my friends in Vegas. Like, my
Harmeet went to a Jewish school.
All
also.
My friends in Vegas are from my synagogue, from Temple Beth Shalom. That's where I know all of them. Like, when I was sick, the only people who would not listen to me, because you remember, I told people, I'm like, let me tell you, for your listeners, you got a friend who gets sick with cancer, it's two things that I didn't want. I didn't want you to call me and ask me how I am. I know how I am. I was terrible. And, you know, for 23 and three quarters hours a day, all I was cancer. That's all I thought.
And
about.
you were wretched.
Yeah.
You
am
were
I gonna die?
Wretched.
Am I going to die? Do I want to die? Do I wish I could die? It was horrible. Don't call me and ask, because for 45 seconds, I was thinking about owls or, you know, metallurgy, anything. Something distracted me. And then, bing. Oh, hey, how you feeling, man?
Cancer.
Right. Aside from the cancer. So thanks for jacking me right back into reality. And the other thing was, don't call me and ask, say, is there anything I can do? If there's something you can do, do it. My cousin Tommy, he made sure that my air conditioning was working the whole time. You know?
Where were you staying then? You
in
were not,
Massachusetts.
You were in Massachusetts. Yeah.
If you have a friend who gets cancer who lives in Las Vegas but has the option to go be treated in Massachusetts and he doesn't, your friend is suicidal. Like, it's, you know, I went to Dana-Farber. Man, it was fantastic. But, you know, they were great. I mean, they put me back together again.
Wow.
You know? And,
wow, wow, wow.
Yeah. But it was, like I said, it was the... if you could take me through, like, it was so bad, Ron, that there was, you know, a point where I was, you know, I'm just, I literally, I gave up. The reason that it was a gift is it taught me something which I never had before, which is humility.
And that's not true.
Oh, Ron.
I'm not saying you, listen, first of all, no one is less qualified to judge anyone regarding humility than myself. But I,
if you do say so yourself,
I heard you, but you always to me were very clear about what your limitations were and, you know, who should handle this, because that's not something that I really could.
That's not humility. That's judgment. I'm talking about humility, man.
Okay. In other words, I'm not really the center of the world. I'm not really the only thing.
That I got from re-believing in God, but the humility of, you know what? I was in St. George, Utah, the couple days before my treatment was to begin, because I went out on a job up there to go do a 4-day.
Were these treatments that had been prescribed for you at Dana-Farber?
Yes. I was going to start my radiation then.
So as they give you a prescription, then you go back to, you can go to Utah. Oh, that was done in Utah.
Right, no, I was in Utah for work.
Oh, okay.
But I was going to start treatment in a couple days. This was my last couple of days before I start getting chemo and nuked. And they were talking about things like, this might do this to you. You might lose your eyes. You might lose your teeth. You might lose your jaw. You might lose your tongue. You might lose your vocal cords. You may lose your life. You know, they gave me 65% chance of survival.
And why does a litigator need any of those things?
Right. And I thought, you know, and what am I doing? And I am thinking, I'm standing there in this cafe waiting to order something. And I thought, what a piece of garbage am I that I'm about to go on this horrible journey? You know, these are my last days of normalcy. And instead of being with my family, I took a, you know, I went out to do a job in Utah. What am I doing? You know, and then I pick up the menu to see what I want. In front of me is a priest in line, a Catholic priest in like Mormon, Utah, right?
Yeah, right.
It's the Feel Love Cafe. I'm like, all right, the sign's getting a little obvious here, right? Right. And then I follow the
God, priest. I asked you for a sign, but you have to be sort of over the top.
Right. I follow the priest to the, you know, to the church, and it's St. George's church. And you know, St. George, like, you know, there's a dragon that you fight, and God gives everybody a dragon to fight. And I'm like, yeah, that's no, the story here is
matchy
not,
matchy, you know?
The story here is not the cliche of like the dragon is my cancer. I'm like, that's stupid. And I saw this statue of the Virgin Mary there, and I was like, you know, it's my pride. It's my lack of humility.
Well,
you know, so I, you know, I literally went and hugged that statue and cried into it.
Gosh.
And
you've had,
I knew it was going to be all right.
Like, really?
I just knew it. The Virgin Mary's not going to let me die, you know? And I was like, but what's funny is, Catholic, especially Sicilian Catholics, we're almost pagans. Like,
you said
with,
it.
You deal with saints, right? I'm like, okay.
You're hugging a statue, so you don't don't have to flesh that out.
I get it. But, you know, it's like we're almost, certain saints have certain jurisdictions. Like, yeah, St. Jude is the saint of hopeless causes.
Right, the hospital.
And my mother said she was going to pray to St. Jude for me. I'm like, don't you dare.
Oh, I don't want to come into her jurisdiction.
What are you doing? The hopeless cause? Go to St. Peregrine. He's the one for cancer. If it looks hopeless, then go to St. Jude. Who are you going to appeal to if St. Jude doesn't come in?
This is why monotheism has a tremendous...
Look,
but it helps you focus. It helps you focus.
And you know, and it was a, that lack of humility. I had never asked God for help. Never. And somebody asked me, why didn't you do that? I'm like, I don't want to bother him. There's kids who have got cancer that need him. And they said, and my friend,
this is a very big deal. You know, right. My father was not a deeply religious man at all, but
I'm not either.
You're not, well, you are and you aren't, but I remember we were watching the World Series once. It might've been Reggie Jackson. He used to cross himself when he got up to bat.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, I said something like, well, why does he think God is going to favor him over the pitcher? I mean,
he doesn't.
And my father, not a theologian, by any stretch of the imagination, said, Ronnie, I don't know, you know, what you're thinking about it, but that's not how it works. He wants to ask God to give him success. It's not him versus the other. Like he nailed it. I don't remember exactly what he said, but
I do it to thank him for the fact that I even get to go there.
Now that you have this in your life, this relationship with God, and this understanding of God, doesn't it? I'm not going to ask it in a stupid way. I'm going to do a leading question. And I never ask a leading question because you don't know what the answer is going to be. But isn't it the case that your everyday life is higher quality now?
Oh my God, yeah.
I mean, isn't that an extraordinary thing? In other words, it's not just, okay, Sunday, that's the day I go to church. And now I'm in that, now, and unlike before where I felt that I was just going through the motions, now I know there's a God. No, now when you have a cup of coffee, there's, I guess, in modern terms, we would call mindfulness. Everything reverberates and has meaning in a way that it didn't before.
And I have superpowers now.
Shit.
Not like laser beams, you know, not like Jews. But, it's like,
stay away from the weather. Talk about jurisdiction. That's ours.
No, but it's like, I am. It's first of all, I'm literally happy. And I'd never been happy. I'd been happy about things, but not happy. You know, and I am like amazed that I get to be alive. I mean, someone complains about the weather. I'm like, it's beautiful. Drizzle is beautiful. I didn't know that I'd ever feel it again. You know, I was laying on the ground, convulsing, like with blood coming out of my throat and thinking, I didn't eat for 10 weeks, man. I lost 60 pounds and not in a good way. You know, they were saying the tumors are going to choke off your jugular veins if we don't, you know, and I was thinking, oh no, but it's beautiful because on the other side of it,
amazing.
You know, it makes me able to even talk like I'm talking now. I was talking, I mean, like I told you earlier, I mean, I don't want to violate any of her privacy, but you know, it's this woman I'm with now. Like she called me when I was kind of just starting to crawl out of the ooze. And she just like started asking me some questions about it. And next thing I knew, I was bearing my soul about all of this, you know? And I'm a very, like, keep out the shell and the spines person. Like, I don't, you know, like, I don't want anybody to get that close to me. I'm screw you, I'm Mark Randazzo. People think my middle name is, you know, effing. Yeah, you know? Get away from me. And I just kind of just opened it all up and like was able to, over the next few months, to like just start talking to her, you know. And then when I kind of fell for her, I was like, you know what, I'm not gonna hold anything back. I'm invincible. Like, what am I gonna do, right? Like, why would you do that? Why would you get more life to not live it to the absolute extreme? And some people think that means like, why am I not skydiving? And why am I not like, you know, doing, that's not what it is. That absolute extreme is like, when I came in, that's why I hugged you that extra time. I'm like, no, I'm not just gonna give you this perfunctory hug. I mean, you have been an important person to me. You've been a mentor to me. You know, you have shown me respect when I didn't deserve it, affection when I didn't deserve it. You know, you stuck up for me when I didn't deserve it. And I'm not going to hug you an uncomfortable amount of time. Like, you should hug people for 20 seconds. It's physiologically, it gets weird after about 5 seconds.
But you should power through that 15 that follows.
Get weird, man. Like, if you're bothering to hug somebody, if you're like in the hug circle, not the handshake circle.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I just married off my youngest a week ago Monday. And then we have a week of what's called Sheva Brachos. It's a week of fedding the couple at different homes. You know, we have been invited to it. And people speak. They speak, and they speak in praise of the couple. They say something from the Torah. And the custom is that the parents and the groom, in our circles, the men do all the speaking, hug and kiss the person who spoke after he spoke. And my wife was like on top, like, you have to kiss him.
What's wrong with that?
I don't have a problem with that, but just it seemed...
You're not using your tongue.
No, hardly ever.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know.
Anyway.
You kissed me when I came in. I thought that
was
beautiful.
No, that's right. No, you have to be.
Of course you do.
Yeah, you have to show
each other enough affection, Ron. Like, not me and you. I'm saying, yeah, like, perfect. You know, on the earth, we don't do that, you know. And I'm, dude, I'm like, I don't care. I'm doing that with everybody. Like, if I care about you,
we're going back to,
not going to forget.
We're going back to your Sicilian roots there also. I mean, they're fairly touchy people, you know.
Yeah, but we're also very spiny. Yeah, it's a very, like,
keep your enemies closer so you can show.
Don't show weakness. I'm like, no, man, I'm going to show every weakness. You're I showed that. The ultimate weakness to God when I was laying there and I was like, I give up. Like, I gave up, Ron.
But you're able still to compartmentalize and kick ass as a litigator?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, like, where you find God, you find liberty. 2 Corinthians 3:17, right?
Excellent. Mark, I think we have given folks what to think about.
I hope so.
I'm so glad that we decided to do this again, and I hope we'll do it again in the future. And it's been a fantastic conversation. The thing about when you and I talk, you don't need a list of questions, you know, because...
No, I didn't even know what we were going to talk about today.
No, me neither either, but we knew we had to do it. And what a fine way to catch up it's been. Thank you so much for stopping by here at the Dillon Law Group in Newark. And thank you for culminating with us. Hey, thank you for listening to the Coleman Nation podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. If you like the show, please rate it 5 stars and leave a review. For more information, please visit the show's website at coleman-nation.com. That's coleman-nation.com. Or you can visit my blog at likelihoodofconfusion.com. Join us next time on the Coleman Nation podcast, and have a great day.